Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry and put that pools in your money and hold that money and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 0.035% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never change anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Get asked the question, Patrick, what can I do to scale my business? And normally the first thing I'll ask them is, what does scalability even mean to you? Meaning, what does it mean to scale your business? Well, I think scalability is for my business to grow faster, or for my business to do this, or for my and I tell them, to me, scalability is for your business to have a life of its own, where it grows with or without you exponentially. And to me, exponentially is doubles. Minimum is a double. So if you go from $100,000 your income to $120,000, to $140,000, to $180,000, to $260,000, that's not exponentially. Exponentially is $100,000, $240,000, $700,000, $1.8 million, $4.2 million. That's scalability. And there's a formula for it that you got to keep asking yourself what you can do to scale your business. And we're going to talk about that today. So first things first. There is a predictable side of the business that's very important to be working on that gives you the opportunity to scale, right? A lot of times entrepreneurs will say, well, I want to start scaling my business right off the bat. And they put so much time and emphasis on scalability, business goes out. It goes out of business because they ran out of funds. They don't have money anymore, and they don't even have the opportunity to scale the business. Before scalability comes, you may put 5 to 10% of your mind thinking about how to scale. But you got to put 90% of your effort in producing a predictable stream of income, even if it's $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 that's bringing in for you to survive and not have to worry about expenses, to ask yourself, how can I scale? So you're working in the business, making sales, growing it, making money, you know, having some support, having some help in the business, scaling the business is what you're thinking about. So how do we do that? Let's talk about that. People will often tell me and say, Pat, listen, the reason why our business is going to explode is because we have the most incredible product in the world. We have the most incredible product in the world. Our product is going to blow up. Look, Rule number one of products. The best products don't always win. There's a lot of books I read. And in some books I read, and I'll say, this was an incredible book, but it did terrible because it wasn't a good, scalable marketing plan in place. And there's some books I just read a book, new book that just came out. And it's one of the books Inc. Magazine recommended as the best book. So I read, I said, no, I didn't learn anything from this book. It's something that's been refurbished from, you know, 20 blogs that he put it into one book. But because he has a platform, it made the book do very well. So his product looks better than somebody else who may have had a great product but terrible scalability. So product doesn't necessarily take you to the next level. The second thing is personality. There's a lot of people that's based on their personality and their businesses based on their personality. Just think about it this way. Very simple. If you die or if you don't exist, what happens to your business? If you die, the business dies. If a business is 100% predicated on your personality, that is not a scalable business. And two, if it is, you're not going to have a life. The more the business grows, the more it's going to suck you in because it's 100% predicated on your personality. What allows you to scale, is if a business is built on a system. The foundation's got to be a system. A system that produces results with the product that you have, not based on your personality. This needs to be number three. If this is number one, this is number two, this is number three. A great system you put in place with a good product and a decent personality will do 10 times better than a great product, a good personality, a decent system. It's not going to scale. You can still make good money with great product, but if you don't have a system, you're not going to scale it. You got to make sure your system is driving your business. So systems could be, you know, a step one, two, three. Somebody comes in, first they see this, then it goes to this, then it goes to this, and they buy. And if they buy, then they have the option to upgrade, they have the option to upsell, they have the option to do this. But this is a streamlined system that takes your business to the next level. Now, what you need with a great system, here's what you do need with a great system. Popovich has a system, but Popovich drives the system. So you'll see some people that have the same system as somebody else in another business, but they don't scale the business because they're not a driver. They're thinking the system's going to scale their business on its own. It's not going to happen. There always needs to be a driver. The triangle offense that Phil Jackson ran with the Lakers and the Bulls only worked because he drove it, okay? Popovich works because he drives it. The New England Patriots keep winning because he has a system that works, but he is the driver. He doesn't have a personality. Belichick is not a personality guy. His product is football. His product is athletes. He knows how to pick good product, but he doesn't necessarily have the best talent all the time, but he knows how to drive it. He knows how to drive it on what he does. So you got to keep in mind, your system, ask yourself, how well is your system, how much your business is based on a system, and how well do you drive it? You'll normally see one of these twos has a flaw, or you're relying way too much on becoming an expert in product and way too much on how great of a personality you have. These two have a short lifespan. This is the only thing that can have a life of its own if there's a driver. And by the way, the driver, you don't have to have the most flamboyant personality to be a great driver. You actually don't. Popovich is not the most flamboyant personality. Phil Jackson is not the most flamboyant personality. But Belichick is not the most flamboyant personality. There's a lot more coaches with flamboyant personalities, but they're not as good of drivers. Drivers do things that you and I never see. Drivers do things that happens right here behind a desk, right there at a conference table, right here where a meeting happens, that they know how to drive a vendor, they know how to drive a partner, an employee, an executive, a team member, a client. They know how to drive that behind closed door that nobody sees, that the average person cannot do because they're just happy with the system they have in place. Now, there's still one more message here on how to scale your business. There's five more steps on scaling your business, and I'm going to leave the last one because I'll tell you the last one what it is, but I want to make sure you get it at the end. Five steps to scaling. One, thinking big. It's very simple, but very few people do it. It doesn't take much, believe it or not, to fill somebody's appetite. It really doesn't. Very few people think big continuously. Now think about it. Somebody may say, well, I'm a bigger thinker than my friends. I get it. But being a bigger thinker than your friends doesn't mean you're a big thinker. You're a small thinker amongst great thinkers. right? So if you always compare yourself to your friend, I'm a bigger thinker than my sister, my brother, my cousin, my nephew, my niece, you're probably going to be a cool big thinker amongst your friends because you make $280 a year or whatever your business is doing. And all respect to you, whatever level you're at with your business. If you're happy with it, that's fine. But to have it scale and have a life of its own, you're not watching this video to find out how to get your business from 240 to 280. That's not the purpose of this video. There's plenty of videos on YouTube to show you how to do that. There's plenty of articles to read. This is about scaling your business. And if you're not refusing to think big, don't count on it being scaled. It's not going to happen, right? There needs to be a big thinker behind it. Apple happened because there was a product expert called Wozniak that I had a chance of interviewing. But behind it, there was a driver called Jobs who drove it because he was a big thinker. Amazon has a big thinker. Anything you think about that scales, there's typically a big thinker there too. Don't celebrate. The celebration lifespan sometimes is too long. You know, people get one victory, one vendor. Oh, my God, we got this big client that's going to give us $600,000 of business per year. This is so exciting. Let's go to a bar today. Hey, our game is on me. Let's go to the Lakers game. Let's go to the next game. It's on me. Let's go to watch the Warriors play. Let's go. Hey, beer tonight. Drinks. Way, way too much celebration. A big thinker doesn't necessarily celebrate a big vendor coming on board because they're expecting that to happen because they're thinking big. A small thinker's lifespan of celebration is way, way too long. That's why they rarely scale, because the moment they make $50,000 a month, and in their mind, they're getting paid way more than what they're worth because their entire goal is tied to a money. Because they get to that point, they don't experience what it is to explode and scale. They stay there too long. Three is in on. You got to spend time working on your business, but knowing when. There's a certain timing here. So if this is a pendulum, okay, if this is a pendulum, this is in. This is on. You spend majority of your time working in your business, and then gradually within 6, 12, 24, 18, you know, whatever months, then you're spending more time on, and then eventually you're working more on your business than you are in your business. But you got to time this well. Sometimes people go on too early, and sometimes people never leave in because they're controlled and they want to micromanage everything, and they never experience scalability. So this is a timing factor that you have to deal with. And then it's the highest return. You gotta, you know, a lot of times as a CEO, I'll run a financial firm, PHP agency, and I'm running the firm, and we'll have a problem that'll come up. Okay, we have a challenge that we have with anything. It could be many different platforms that we have challenged. And we'll have a meeting, and I'll say, okay, how can we solve this problem? And we'll make a list. We'll process this together. We'll make a list, and we'll say, if we do this, we can do this. If we do this, we can do that. If we do this, perfect. That solves the problem, right? Yes. But it's not the optimal solution. It's a solution. It's not the optimal solution. I'm looking for the optimal solution. The optimal solution is what is going to be able to put us in a position to not have to face this issue again 6 months from now, or are we simply putting a Band-Aid on this problem that we have to face 7 months later? And why are we doing that? A lot of times when you're a leader of a business, the entrepreneur, you'll face an issue. I see too often trying to build a business with Band-Aids than actually sitting down and saying, what can I do for this pain to go away? That's what I'm looking for, because I don't want to have more issues coming out later on that we're looking at having to overcome 6, 7, 8 months later. No, optimal solution. So if I can invest money back into my business and I sit there and we're having a meeting, we have $300,000 to put back into the business. Great. I think we should do it here. We should do it here. We should do it here. It's great. Let's hire 3 new people and pop, 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 pop. That's what we need to be doing. Excellent. Let's do that. Awesome. Great job, guys. No. What can we do to get the highest possible return that's the optimal solution to scale the business to the next level and not just throw money away at something that will give us 6% return? Why don't we spend another hour in the meeting and try to find out what's going to give us 13% return, and let's sleep on it and find out tomorrow what we can do to get a 19% return, and maybe we find out we can do a 29% return if we do this. Optimal solution, scalability. And the last one I left blank because the last one is an art. The last one is an art. The last one is an art that you know, it takes a while to learn, and you're continuously going to learn this. And if the last one is something that you don't touch, if the last one is something that you don't embrace, you're lowering the chances of you being able to scale. It can still scale, but the last one is going to give you the highest level of scalability. And that is leverage. Leverage, leverage, leverage. So how do you leverage? Look, knowing you don't have all the answers and you bring somebody in who's the opposing strength of you. If you're a pure, you know, profit visionary type of a CEO and you're terrible with operations, don't try to be operations. You got to leverage somebody with operations to help you with the systems to increase the speed. If you're an operations type of person and you're not a great driver, you're just purely operations, and your driving skills are not good, you need to bring a driver to be able to drive the company. Don't try to be a CEO known behind closed doors. You are an operation guy. You keep only thinking about that, and no wonder there's not somebody driving a business. Maybe you're a good CFO and you need help with an operations or a CEO person. All you care about is money, money, money. You're always worried about, we can't spend money on that, we can't spend money on, we can't spend money. And because of how cheap you are, you don't know how to leverage somebody else to tell you, we need to invest into this, we need to buy this software, we need to go and do it, we need to invest into marketing. You're not going to scale. What leverage is partnerships, right vendors, a partner that's going to come that you may have to give something in return to be able to scale the business with. That's all leverage. So what can you do to leverage time? What can you do to leverage your business? What can you do to leverage your vendors? What can you do to leverage your partners? What can you do to leverage the executive team around you? What can you do to leverage your team, consultants? What can you do to leverage someone that's going to help you scale the business, not somebody just throwing money away either. You don't hire aggressively all the time. You're hiring very slow. You're firing very fast. But all you're thinking about is, what position can I put myself into to help me leverage the business to scale it to a whole different level that I possibly couldn't do by myself? And if you do those things, it's not just a one area. You got to go back and watch this video one more time and ask yourself, am I spending more time on predictable side or scalable side? Am I more a product person? Am I more personality? Do I drive my business based on system? You know, what am I most of the time working on this? And then ask yourself these five areas, how well you are. And then slowly but surely, ask yourself what phase of this business you are. And on, start asking yourself, I want to scale. How do I scale? How do I do this? How do I do that? And slowly but surely, you'll get better at that. And then all of a sudden, the year, you have a double. It's got to be a minimum of a double. That's scaling your business when you start having some doubles in measurable numbers that you're looking at that is doubling. That's scalability. That's my message to you about scaling. If you got any questions about it, comment on the bottom. And if you haven't subscribed to this channel, please do so as well. Thanks for watching.
Being a black farmer has always been difficult. And I always knew there was a problem, but I really didn't get it until I was the one that they were doing it to. It means so much because I remember my dad taking me riding in a truck. You had tractors moving, dirt was being thrown over. It was the best feeling. You definitely want your kids to take over the farm for you to keep that legacy going.
The number of black farmers in America has been steadily declining since the 1920s. Once accounting for 14% of all farmers, today, they make up less than 2%. It got me wondering, what's happening to all the black farmers?
We are fourth generation cane farmers. That's all we did. I mean, from my grandfather to my great-grandfather,
I farmed with my two brothers and my dad.
Unlike some struggling crop growers and dairy farmers, sugarcane farmers enjoy regulated prices, which have made sugarcane a wealth crop. June and Angie Provost are sugarcane farmers in Louisiana, and a line of black farmers before them.
Probably 5, 6, I remember my dad just taking me ride in the field, looking at the tractors. I would just try to do everything my dad did. He would always put his arm out the window, so I did the same thing.
I was lucky enough to have a business where we can go and enjoy doing what we love every day. It was never a job. I would get up 4:30, 5 o'clock every morning, and we all would go in the field. You had tractors moving, dirt was being thrown over. It was the best feeling. It's a smell when the air moves. Get that breeze and you get that smell comes after you like it's indescribable. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. It was my safe place. It was where I felt most comfortable at.
I'm gonna look for it because Bryson.
We were a community of African American farmers. I mean, you're talking about probably over 50 farmers, farm families. Now, you know, in Louisiana, there's 450,000 acres grown of sugarcane. There are only 4 African American families left. There's a problem.
All the black farms were, I mean, pretty much family farms. It wasn't just like one single.
Yeah, it wasn't a single. It was a family.
It was
that's,
family.
That's
I
how
mean,
they were doing it. Because I still got my boy, BJ, right now. Still asking, Daddy, why are you not farming no more, man? I wanted to do that. And
yeah.
How do you explain that?
This is a 1994 High Yield Awards. My dad, I think, was 15th place in the top 20 in the state. My oldest brother, he was first place. And I was non-quota, first place in the state. I had 8,588 pounds of sugar on 21 acres, and the state average was 5,460 pounds, so almost double the state average.
I met June around February of 2008. He opened the door. It was like, da-da-da-da-da-da. We were like really
inseparable
since the first moment that we met. When I first met June, I felt like all the hard work that he was doing, that it wasn't paying off for him in some sort of way. Something didn't feel right. I would go with him periodically to the USDA office or to the bank or to even the mill. And I would hear him talk to these loan officers, mill presidents, and it was almost as if he were being disrespected in his face, as if he didn't know what he was talking about. That was something that occurred for years.
First Guaranty Bank made me downsize in 2013. I'm like, why should I have to downsize? I have bills out there for at least a 3,000-4,000 acre farm. Well, you won't get a loan unless you downsize to 1,200 acres. In 2014, I didn't get my crop loan until June 16th. Everybody came, their crops were finished, they were green, they were growing, they're about to start planting cane in a month, month and a half. Here I am just getting in the fields.
The lender, First Guaranty, did not respond to our request for comment.
In sugarcane, you need your loan in February. Starting from like 2008, the crops loan started in March, then it got the end of March, then it started in April, then May. I mean, every year the crop was longer and longer delayed.
So if you are a month or two behind, that is crucial. That means your crop is going to be behind for the rest until harvest season. And it's a trickle-down effect. So if your cane is behind, your planting is going to be behind. So not only that you're going to be suffering for that 1 year, that cane there is going to be your next crop for the next 3-4 years. So it's a trickle-down effect. It's not like 1 year you can regroup and you're going to be okay. When you harvest the cane, this right here, you're actually going to cut this top off.
Oh, sugar cane is a wealth crop. For a 1,000-acre farm, your net profit is close to $150,000 to $200,000.
In 2016, the average sugarcane farm in Louisiana was 870 acres. June and his family once farmed up to 5,000 acres. The provost believed large black farms drew negative attention from the overwhelmingly white farm community and agriculture institutions.
That's where I think that the threat came from with black farmers, because you had so many farmers who were farming 1,500 acres and upwards.
All of the black farmers that went out, always what we heard, well, their farming practices, or they don't work hard enough, or they only work 3-4 days out of the week. And that is the furthest from the truth. What you don't realize, if you're underfunded, if you're getting your loans late, that is a huge thing on a farm, especially with sugarcane. You have a small window to get out in the field and work your crops.
We've had issues with lenders who've been discriminating against black farmers.
What Angie's describing was the subject of a massive class action suit brought by black farmers. Known as the Pickford lawsuit, farmers alleged that the United States Department of Agriculture was discriminating on the basis of race by limiting and delaying black farmers' access to loans. Thousands of farmers joined the class action, including June and his father, and it resulted in the largest settlement in U.S. government history, and ultimately led to an admission of discriminatory practices within the USDA. U.S. Census data points to stark disparities between black and white farmers. When it came to a federal loan called Commodity Credit Corporation, in 2007, black farmers received an average of $28,408, while their white counterparts received triple that amount of the black farmers.
So in 2014, the problems and issues that we were going through just catapulted.
Which is when they say M.A. Patu, the sugar mill, refused to honor a contract to harvest June's hundreds of acres of sugarcane. The sugar mill did not respond to our request for comment.
Either possibly leave my cane standing in the field or sign a new contract they could have charged up to $10 a ton if they wanted to. If your cane is left in the field, I mean, you won't have any money to get another crop loan. Your farm is done. That was one of the hardest decisions of my life.
They left 3/4 of my crop uncut.
June estimates that was a loss of at least $500,000, just in crops alone.
That finished putting me out completely.
Protect us against all harm, all evil, and all wrongdoing. Forgive us of our trespasses as we forgive those who have trespassed against us. Amen.
Forced to make an impossible decision, June stopped farming.
The legacy he left is gone.
Not gone. You're here and you fight. You're here and you fight. Your dad is with you.
Everybody told me the day of this funeral that he's where you want to be, looking at the cane and looking at the mill. But it's not like that no more. And I feel like I let my dad down by them taking away our legacy. We have a tractor and some sugar cane. That was a must.
It makes me angry when I look at June and I look at his father's gravesite and I think of all the other young men and women who have passed away at early ages because of hard labor. And I look at a sugar mill, a sugar plantation built by slaves. It makes me angry.
There are not many African American farmers left. And the rate they're going right now, there won't be any more in 5 to 10 years. So I'm going to fight until I can't fight anymore.
You can't see a growth in white sugarcane farmers while seeing a decline in black farmers and say that race has nothing to do with it.
And that was awful.
Now that we're in financial trouble, First Guarantee wants to foreclose on this home.
I mean, the embarrassment, the knowing that you won't be able to get a crop loan again, knowing that your career is literally gone. I have nightmares. I see psychologists. I'm having the hardest time. In possibly a month, I can lose my house, property. It's hard to deal with this.
I know a lot of farmers are going through this.
Mm-hmm.
June and Angie don't think their experience is unique. They see institutional discrimination across much of the industry as a big reason for the decline of black farmers.
And I always knew there was a problem, but I really didn't get it until I was the one that they were doing it to. And it just opened my eyes up completely. And it's like, wow, you know, they did it to me. They did it to my family members. The whole community of black farmers, they did it to.
The provost have decided to file 2 lawsuits. One against the sugar mill, M.A. Patu, and another against First Guarantee Bank.
A family of sons and a father who maintained sugarcane operations for, in this case, at least 3 generations. You don't go out of business because of bad farming practices. There are some outside third-party influences that will cause the demise of an experienced sugarcane operation. It's just shocking to see that these practices continue in 2018. To have to leave your profession under a cloud of discriminatory practices is very disheartening. It causes depression. It causes a lot of hopelessness.
While neither the sugar mill nor the bank have responded to our request for comment, in a previous statement to The Guardian, First Guaranty Bank denied any discriminatory practices.
You are hereby notified that by virtue of writ of possession issued by the Honorable 16th Judicial District Court of Louisiana in and for Iberia Parish, after 24 hours from date of this service, I will place Mortgage Company First Guaranty Bank in full and complete possession of the property belonging to said adjudicate of share sale, being the following described property.
Still shaking, because this is a loss that's just indescribable. I mean, to say, you know, come do this and then tomorrow they're going to come and change the lock, this is unreal. This is unreal.
We are challenging your crooked mindset, your backwards mindset, your Jim Crow mindset. We'll pass it on to our kids. We'll pass it on to our family members. Make sure that when we're gone, that they will continue to push back.
Despite the loss of their home and the ongoing lawsuits, the provosts are determined to once again farm.
Okay, we're waiting for today's podcast. Is titled Earth Wealth Energy Plantations. That's Earth Wealth Energy Plantations. And we're waiting for this next. Oh, it's already going. All right, we'll get back to you.
I often get asked the question, Patrick, what can I do to...
Sometimes I get up to 500,000 in a month.
Meet Martha Otieno, a role model to many farmers in Homa Bay County. Martha, who studied journalism at St. Augustine University in Tanzania, gave up on her career in 2011 when she failed to get employment in the competitive job market.
Doing farming, though I professionally I am a journalist. I sacrificed about 40,000. You know, 40,000 when you're not working, it's a lot of money. So I sacrificed 40,000. I invested into farming, but then unfortunately I lost everything.
This didn't prevent her from venturing into the new field, even knowing that she didn't have her own farm to practice agriculture.
I consider myself young. I'm not yet married, and with our culture, we're not supposed to get land from our parents.
Through determination, Martha worked closely with farmers who would lease sections of their farm to her.
I remember tunakutana na huyu dada Martha akasema yeye pia ni mkulima. Alafu akasema yeye ana shamba kubwa, nikasema niko na shamba kubwa kuja tulime. Alafu tukalima pamoja. Yeye inaleta mbegu na mbolea mimi napatia shamba. Vitu ambavyo tumepata kutoka kwa shamba tunagawana.
Her past experience when entering into farming made her seek advice from agronomists on proper planning methods to maximize food production. She began to acquire pieces of land in Rachuonyo, Mbita, Suba and Nyatike, where she rotates pepper, groundnuts, maize and watermelon. She rears fish as well.
We have three clans, three categories of clans here. First, we have the community around. Those are our first clans. And then the second clans are people living in town, of which the next town is Homa Bay. So that is the second kind of clans. And then we have the third kind of clans of whom are consuming a large quantity of watermelon. So that is in Nairobi.
But how does Martha get to make millions, yet she is in small-scale farming?
That is possible because at the moment I don't only do one farm. At the moment I have about 4 acres on watermelon, and usually for 1 acre, when you do it at the right time and you get the right market for your produce, I normally sell them at between 300 and 350,000. So when you have 4 acres, that's how I come to get that much.
Being the proper planner she is, at times Mother Nature dampens Martha's spirit.
No, I'm not depending on rains. Yeah, I'm just doing this because the farms that I have along the river were swept by floods just recently. I lost about 2 acres, and those are some of the challenges I'm facing.
Mother Otieno is already making it big in the agriculture sector. Despite the shortcomings that come along with the heavy rains, she hopes that planting watermelons here will make up for the loss. Brenda Cheriot, Citizen TV, Homa Bay County.
Okay, today's podcast is titled Earth Wealth Energy Plantations, and for some people that might be cut off, that don't like the word plantation, all a plantation is a commercial farm. That's what it is, a commercial farm. Now, the first audio we played was how to scale your business, and I want to sort of center this around the second audio we played with the black farmer. Like they say, it's a dwindling number. At least it was at the time of that recording. And one of the things, well, a few of the things that, in my opinion, there's an educational abyss that's missing, in my opinion, when it comes to, on a critical mass basis, African Americans, when it comes to farming and ranching. It's not so much, in my opinion, discrimination or Jim Crowism and all that. Is number one, we weren't taught how to scale. And my definition of scaling is really, really simple. Is, let's say you are good at making a hamburger or a hot dog. Pick your commodity. And not only are you good at making a hamburger, let's say you're good at making a hamburger, you can make a nice, decent, not spectacular, but nice, decent, edible hamburger or hot dog. You can make it from scratch and have it on a person's plate within 10 to 15 minutes of a person ordering. You're good at that. And you're good, you charge a fair price, and you make a profit off of selling those one burger or one hot dog at a time. All right. My definition of scaling is, instead of you doing it by yourself, getting partners, not employees, but getting partners and you might get one part, let's say two partners, five partners, 10 partners, and you're scaling it up. So instead, like month one, let's say the first year, it was you by yourself. Okay. Now you're making out all right. You're making a living. But then year two, let's say you double it. So you get a partner, you train that partner, and you've doubled your output. Now, let's get geometric with it. Okay, you got two locations times 10. Third year, you're up to 20. Actually, 22. All right. So my definition of scaling is whatever you're good at, okay, just do it again, not necessarily in the same location, but in a different location. Okay, different part of town, different states, different countries. And you're not reinventing the wheel. You're just taking the wheel that you already know and doing it or duplicating it in another location. That's my simplified version of scaling. All right. Now, going back to the second audio, where the young man, and I guess his wife or girlfriend, more than likely from the sound of the conversation coming from him, number one, he wasn't taught how to scale farm operations. And number two, he wasn't taught, as a matter of fact, and here's why I like to use the word plantation. Many plantations back during the Civil War times and colonial times, they had schools there that taught, as far as American plantations go at that time, taught people, matter of fact, they even do it today. They had schools on the plantations that taught the workers how to do specific jobs. Now, listening to that guy, because he was talking about, I went to the bank. This is why I love the Amish and Mennonite community so much. Matter of fact, we got to bring Albert Lee back on here soon. They don't really rely on outside banks. They set things up from within the family or within the community. So, from the sound of what I heard this guy and his lady friend talking about, or his wife talking about, number one, he wasn't taught scaling, how to scale a farm business. He wasn't taught how to organize and set up and maintain a family-run bank. It's not open to the public. It's not open to the neighbors. It's a family bank. And it's run for the private use of that family only, particularly when it comes to, well, it can come to any aspect. I know a family where they have one particular uncle where when they need a down payment for a car, or even if they need a car financed, or even a house, they go to this particular uncle or brother. And that's how they roll in that family. And this is in 2020 right now. So he wasn't taught that. And number three, he wasn't taught compliance and inflation. Because with compliance, you need to have somebody within your family business that keeps up with the current rules and regulations. And that, they need to monitor that on, I would say, a weekly basis. Those rules might stay in place on a local, state, or federal level or whatever for a whole year. Or something might pop up every 90 days, or there's a meeting of some sort on possible or future rule changes that happens every month. You need a compliance person. That's all they do is make sure they know what are the current rules and regulations and have relationships with people who interpret those rules and regulations. That's all under the compliance hat. Because, and now, if you don't know what I just said, if you're not keeping up with the current rules and regulations, if you don't set up your own family financing institution within your family, within your household, that's when you start blaming third-party people because you haven't set this up for yourself. I'm going to play one more audio before we go to the phone lines. And like I say, during this downtime, I would say you need to use this as prep time to get yourself in a debt-free position as much as possible.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second, and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land, okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively. And you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
Okay, and that's just your basic peace of mind for the roof over your head. Today, and probably every day, I'm picking up a new skill here. I'm sewing. So today I got the materials already. I shall be putting together something real simple, face mask. So I don't watch a bunch of videos on it. It seems pretty idiot-proof. In any event, I'll keep you updated on it. A friend of mine called me yesterday because I got the machines and everything, but I don't think I'll need a machine. Just fold here, fold there, sew this on, and if it looks decent, I'll put it up on Facebook so you guys can see it. In any event, we're still in this pandemic. Although,
what's going on in LA? You see the email I sent you?
Oh no, I haven't gone to those yet.
Man, you really gonna like that one.
Okay, hold on, let me go to it now.
But you don't have to get in no hurry. You don't have to get in no hurry.
Let
me comment on on the farmer thing. And
okay.
I think you hit on some good issues. You know, I was looking into some rice farming. Not looking into, but I wanted to buy some rice. I don't remember how many metric tons we wanted. And I was looking for some black farmers. Couldn't find any. Now, you got black farmers that grow, but you don't have no black farming company that has the mills, the mill the rice.
Right.
And see, the way that works is that the mill buys your rice if you're in contract with them to do that. And they'll mill the rice and store it. Then when the commodity market is right, they would take their stored rice and put it and sell it. And they wait till the market is right so that they can make money. And people that commodity trade, I don't commodity trade, I stock and option trade. Matter of fact, in the last 7 days, I think I made a couple of accounts I played around with because I was trying to teach some young people about $2,600 trading with a TD American trade. But this guy, and I'm not making fun of him, but it is tragic. But blacks need to have their own milling company if they're going to be, enough of them going to be involved in sugarcane or anything else, or you sell it to a company. And also, you got to get, I mean, if you've been in business for a period of time, okay, and you're growing crops at a profit, because if you grow crops at a loss, the government will subsidize you. The difference between what you had to sell and what you was hoping the market to be. Plus, you have crop insurance, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't understand why every growing season you have to go to the bank. If you made profit on your last crops, and it may be something that I'm not privileged to, if you made profits off your last crop, and if you had losses for whatever reason, your crops are insured. That's one of the costs in production is insurance. Then you shouldn't have to go to the bank every year.
I agree.
And then, like you said, and this is where Beasley's suggestion has come in, and believe it or not, there does exist these cooperatives, black cooperatives down south, the Mississippi Valley, black farmers cooperatives. You got one in Mississippi Valley. You got one, I think, in Georgia. And the guy that was in charge of the one, the Mississippi Valley, I think his name is Mr. Page. I talked to him. And for those who don't, is looking to get involved in that, they could contact the Agriculture Department in Alcorn University. It's a historical black college. They have an excellent agriculture program. And the people there will talk to them. So it kind of baffles me. And like I say, I don't know everything that's involved to the specifics. And of course, this is a family whose concerns may be different from everybody else's or the norm.
Right.
But I don't see why come that I don't see why that is like it is.
That's true.
I really
do. Did you need listen to the Female Solution this morning?
No, I was someplace else.
Okay. It
and you know another. Who would have
on? Pretty interesting guest from a Black Farmers Association. It was a pretty interesting guest.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, I looked at her heading and didn't talk about no Black Farmers Association. Unless I was looking at an old one.
That's what I got. They did a live one.
The way she advertised it.
The way she worded it. It was supposed to be on last week, but I don't think, like you just said, they didn't advertise it that way.
Yeah. Hey, you know, another thing, too. Out of those issues with the black farmers and the settlement with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a lot of things sprung forth. And, you know, if you got, for instance, trees on your property, like in Georgia, USDA would come out and do workshops with you on how to make money off of that timber that you have on your property. If you wanted to get into farming of a particular livestock, say goats, for instance, the USDA will provide you with the kid goats to get you started, from what I understand. And any other venture, whether it's if you want to have a fish pond, commercial fish pond, they'll stock your pond for you. Matter of fact, the state will too, with fingerlings. It's what they call the baby fish. And I know they'll do it. I think they'll do it on chickens too. I'm not sure. Because I talked to a lady, it's a black woman in Georgia who raises goats. And there's a Black Farmers Organic Farm Association too down south. So a lot of information is not being told on what's available in order for you to take on a venture and be successful with it. But I can't imagine somebody, if somebody's having to go out and mortgage their house and their land every year just to put crops in, something wrong with that picture. I mean, I can see you
that's
doing it 1 year.
The educational abyss. And basically, that in my opinion, you gotta figure out, right, what am I missing, and how can I get myself, you know, get educated on it, you know, network the resources that you just talked about, because it's too easy to say, well, there's discrimination or that I'm black, or that's not solving the problem at all.
Yeah. Because when I was in business, I could go get $100,000 just on my signature alone from one bank, not including several that I was working with.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm black.
And you learn,
and if it was a project,
you learn what to do. That's the key.
Yeah, if it was a project, that project, if I needed to get the money for payroll, well, I would get money for payroll. And all I have to do is show them a cash flow and my latest financials. and they put the money in the bank, in the account, in the payroll account. If I wanted to buy equipment, I would buy equipment the same way, because, you know, buying equipment is different. You can use the equipment for collateral if they wanted to.
Right.
And you always have to, you know, you always put up a house. And it's best that you're married.
Right.
Because
I got to take a quick break because somebody's calling me. Let me take this call.
One in a Million, the history of Madam C.J. Walker and her entrepreneurial legacy. Not even her poor and difficult beginnings stymied Madam Walker's road to greatness. Born December 23, 1867, roughly 2 years after the alleged emancipation of her race, she was an orphan at 7, a wife at 14, a mother at 17, and a widow by 20. The woman who would become known as the first self-made female millionaire and the greatest benefactress of her race was born the daughter of Owen and Minerva Breedlove, poor ex-slaves living on a cotton farm in Louisiana. They named their special little girl Sarah Breedlove. A washerwoman by trade, at the age of 33 in 1900, Sarah began selling a product door to door which she had formulated to remedy her own hair loss. She pinpointed the root of her hair problems, which was the scalp, and created hair care products and a beauty regimen for hair growth and maintenance that focused on the need for a clean and healthy scalp, scalp protection, and scalp stimulation for maximum hair growth. Her first product would eventually be called Madam C.J. Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower, and she boldly and proudly used her own likeness on her jars and her own before and after pictures to demonstrate her product's effectiveness. Per Madam's own words, she abhorred the impression held by some that she claimed to straighten hair. She emphatically stated, "I grow hair," and that there would be no hair-growing business today had I not started it. She described her concept and method of hair growth as beauty culture because she compared growing hair...
Well, I'm not going to do that again. As somebody called me about auto insurance, so as they went into their pitch, I hung up on them. Anyway, and then I went and checked on something in the kitchen. So, Pianca, I apologize. I'm not going to do that no more. So, I'm going to leave these phones off.
Okay.
Anyway, Pianca, where were we when I allowed that call to interrupt?
Well, I was mentioning some of my experiences. But that's just the... the way it is, then, you know, I'm supportive of black owned companies, and if it's the desire of a group of people to have grocery stores, then they need to have a segment of their operations or their overall plan. Start producing the stuff that you're going to sell in these stores. And I don't know how in the world you would do that because I don't think you got the capacity. Sure, you don't have it here in the United States because of the growing season. You know, you still have to get items from other people. And in some cases, from other countries, unless you have operations going on, which we know have been the case in the past with operations like Chiquita. And Dole, they're located in the United States, but they have farms in other countries.
That's true. The multinationals.
If you had, you could go to Green Giant or whoever does their canning, and they would do your canning too. Matter of fact, Green Giant would can their green beans under your label if that's what you chose to do.
True.
So you could have name brand labels like your Aldi's and your Shop and Save, two that comes to my mind. I think Schnucks have it. Kroger's have their own name brand. And the canned substance is probably produced and canned in the same cannery that produces some of your name brand stuff. Del Monte, like I made mention. Green Giant. You have to ask yourself, have you ever went into the store and you see these name brands you ain't never heard of that's in like an ethnic section, like Mexican, for instance? They have Godiva. I never heard no Godiva before until I really started paying attention to it. So you have to ask yourself, where in the world are these people getting these canned goods? Process that.
Right.
They surely ain't processing them way down in Venezuela and shipping them up here. Hell, Venezuelans don't have food on their shelves themselves.
True. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think some of them, man, I've seen some audio, not audios, on Facebook, not Facebook, YouTube, where in some cases, I don't know how rampant it is, people at the gas station, instead of paying with the local currency, they're paying with a loaf of bread or some other cigarette, you know, stuff.
Hey, bartering,
but
huh?
Once again, I don't know how rampant that is. And then to tell the truth, you also got a question, right? Who's doing the reporting? So, stuff like that. But, I got a question for you. I guess your guess is as good as anyone's. How long do you think, before I even ask the question, okay. The governors of California, Oregon, and Washington State, West Coast, they're putting together some type of commission or task force to get those three states back open again. And then on the East Coast, New York State, Delaware, I think Massachusetts, New Jersey, they're pulling together to do the same thing in their region. So now with that said, like I said, your guess is as good as anybody. When do you think things will be returning to, well, not returning, but when do you think the new normal will, where everything, the borders are open again and people can move about like this, or at least sort of like they used to?
Well, I think it's closer than ever. I don't think they ever should have. Well, I can understand, but some of these lockdowns is ridiculous. But that's up to the government. It's really not up to Donald Trump, unless you're talking about government agencies like Social Security Office. The post office is still open. But those are federal offices, and he has control over them. Now, as far as your regular retail shops and restaurants, that's the local community and the governor of that particular state.
Mm-hmm.
And now, as far as
right.
people gathering in that, technically, you can't tell people not to gather. People have the protection to gather, assemble, by way of the U.S. Constitution. And no pandemic trumps the U.S. Constitution. And it's very dangerous to let that go on the way it is, because what happened, they would use a pandemic or something they would consider as being not essential, like gun sales, are dangerous to your health, like the next flew or like bungee jumping or some stuff like that, they will use those reasons to stop you from participating in that behavior. And I think that that's wrong. It's the same way you see another thing. They blame everything on coronavirus. They had a father and son.
You know, some people are going to exploit that.
Yeah, they do.
Their advantage, yeah.
You had one story in Detroit, two of them, really. Well, you had guys out on the lake fishing in their boats, and they wanted to give them tickets. Then you had a father and a son die who was black. And you should see the story with pictures as far as this funeral procession is operation is going. But, you know, here's the thing. They never tell you, unless you go digging around, what killed them, what they died from. They just say they died from the coronavirus.
Well, that's
what the coronavirus didn't kill
them. That's what they've been doing with AIDS from the get-go. They don't talk about, well, this person had pneumonia or, you know, AIDS
right.
is a virus, but you drop dead from pneumonia or whatever.
You're absolutely right. Then they tell you that black people are dying at a higher rate than everybody else. And
yeah.
that it's affecting them.
You know what?
Well,
Piyaki,
that's just.
I thought this naively. I thought for once, race wasn't going to be brought up. But eventually.
No, man. Well, you know who's bringing this race up, don't you? It's black folks that's using this. And I'll tell you in this story. For instance, they got this thing out where they're saying 70%. Of the deaths in Louisiana are black people.
Mm-hmm.
70%.
About the same as Chicago.
Hang on for a second, Eli.
Mm-hmm.
Now let me tell you something. What I done, and this was last Friday, it was like 755 total. State death in Louisiana, according to NPR. Now I understand it's like up to 887 today. Okay. You can't find out. You really can't use. Blacks make up 32% of the population in Louisiana. They say their rate of dying is 70%. Okay. The largest concentration of black people is in New Orleans. In Louisiana.
There's a lot down
from
there.
From my understanding. There's 391,000.
That's part of my family's from down there.
I know. Now listen to this, L.A. There's 391,006 people, population of New Orleans. Of that, 59% is black. That 59% equate to 233,587 blacks in New Orleans. Now, I could never find out how many blacks is dying of COVID in New Orleans. But so what I done is said, well, let's take everybody that's died in the whole state, black, white, and everybody else, and do a mathematics formula on it. All right, and 755 was the total state death. Of 70% of them is black. That's 529.
Mm-hmm.
529 divided by 233,587 is 0.2%.
I know. You see, you're thinking the way I was thinking, because I was thinking, man, more people die from pneumonia, flu, and all that.
In St. Louis City. One newspaper said 82% of the deaths in St. Louis are black. They had 19 deaths in St. Louis and 17 was blacks. Blacks make up 157,000 people in the city of St. Louis. That's less than 0.01% of the deaths in the city of St. Louis. But they put out these articles and say 82% of all COVID-19 deaths in the city of St. Louis are black. Oh, my God. White folks is trying to kill us. The days are after us. See, I told you so. People are ignorant, man. They are just totally, totally ignorant.
That's true.
If you are contagious under normal,
Before that, they had when this stuff started really coming out, they had this on YouTube. They had some blacks that were saying that due to the fact that we have melanin, we can't get COVID.
Oh yeah, super melanins. One of them super melanin excuses.
That got started, so.
Like the Zulus tried to use against the British. In all honesty, you had an Indian, and I can't think of his name, in the tribe when they had the war on the Great Lakes between the British and the Native Americans. He done the same thing. Supposedly rubbed some juice on his body that's going to deflect bullets. You had Indians like Sitting Bull sit out in the sun and stare at the sun rocking back and forth. Like that's supposed to protect them. Then, of course, you got blacks who say we got magic melanin that it don't affect us like it affects the quote-unquote them. The
right.
Zulus, when they were fighting the British, they were supposed to have put some magic something on them that's supposed to deflect the bullets. Yeah, right.
Well... So much for that theory.
But no, the way these news media get away, and I call it misinformation, drive-by news, and get people all worked up on some sloppy information, and people fall for it. Folks don't think, man. It's the same way with everybody who want to have masks on. I thought when you contagious, you wear masks to protect other people.
Right.
What about the people who don't cure themselves from it? Are you saying that they can catch it again?
And
no, are you saying that it's in the air?
They're putting those numbers out there because a number of people, a lot more people have been, you know, cured up than have actually died. But and they put those numbers out there a little bit, but you know how the news operates. If it bleeds or in this case, if it dies or whatever, they really
Then you got Chinese that's supposed to be putting Africans out.
Yep.
And you got black Americans here in the United States is getting all riled up about that. Oh, look what they're doing to the black folks. I say, them ain't black. Those are Africans. They don't consider themselves like you consider yourself. But
right.
Wait a minute. Hang on for a second. In Uganda, they're doing the same thing. They are containing the Chinese. And guess what? When you see a picture of who's in the cage, you not only have yellow Chinese, you have black Chinese in the cage.
And there are plenty of black Chinese, more coming every day.
So where's the racism? And then if you really want to take it a little bit further, this is in Uganda. What did Idi Amin do when he was in power?
He put all the Asians out, didn't he?
You're damn right he did. Where is the outcry?
Good point.
See, if you're not thinking, if you don't think critically, and then if you are black and you listen to these vicious people that want to try to keep telling a particular narrative that keep you coming back, like coming back to church every Sunday after 40
mm-hmm.
years. Then you're going to get trapped and fooled with that mess. If folks want to bleed that stuff like that, fine. But stay the hell away from my kids. Don't be teaching my kids that. Teach your kids that.
Right.
I catch you teaching my kids that, I'm gonna, you're going to have some problems. That dumb mess. But anyway, I work with some young, I was teaching, well, I was in on a conference call Saturday on stocks and options. You know, I used to be a stock and option trader, still is a little bit, not like I used to, as I'm teaching. I work with a young man that we started this back in the 1990s, him and another guy, Mr. Jones, a young man, he's still at it. And I'm happy to see that he's doing well. The other kid, he's doing excellent. Lamont used to be in the business of doing lectures, talking about Black history. He used to bring Khalid Muhammad into St. Louis one time. Steve Coakley into St. Louis maybe a couple of times. Dr. Africa, Roanoke Oroshidi. I told Kyle Leaf, I used to sponsor him. I've given him tens of thousands of dollars on equipment and stuff. I told him, I said, man, you need to cut this stuff out. You're going to be broke as hell.
Hey,
so he listened.
I met Steve Coakley years ago in D.C., actually Silver Spring Rental right outside of D.C. He was healthy looking then. This had to be in,
I don't know what he died from. Maybe he died from COVID-19. I don't know,
but they've got some video of him. This is part of, well, I guess, man, he does look really sick on these YouTube videos. And then he eventually,
I don't know what happened to Steve.
Yeah,
I know Steve
happened.
Used to like to talk that stuff. He wouldn't talk until you passed the basket around.
Yes.
But no, we was talking to them. And my grandson and one of his classmates and some other people was online, a woman and Black woman and another Black man. And I think there's going to be more of them for next time we do it. But we're trying to show them how to trade stocks and options, because you can make money at it, especially the way the markets are today. It's a damn good time to make money in the markets. You couldn't ask for a better scenario. And a lot of them are using a certain brand trading platform. I think it's I can't think of the name of it right now. Robinhood, they call it. And I told my grandson I wouldn't fool with it. I told him to use TD Ameritrade. See, they used to be, back when we did, they had a company called Option Express.
Okay.
It had the best trading platform I've ever seen. InvestTrade was another. Option Express went out of business, and their algorithms was bought by TD, and they use one trading platform called thinkorswim. Now you can trade your own. So we was teaching them how to do it, and I hope they could show which is better. They get a hang of kids. Now, I can understand my grandson. You got so much stuff to do. But I tell him you should just spend 15 minutes a day and, you know, check your position and learn a little bit about this, a little bit about that. Then spend 15 minutes on the next thing and 15, then do your work. Because you just can't do one thing. You got to run these things simultaneously because you're working against time. One thing, I ain't going to be around all the time. That's the big thing. Because your best bet is when you got people who have done these things and done them well, that can teach you and coach you. And you want to take advantage of that while they're around. Because once they're gone, they're gone. And all that you don't know that they had to show you, you got to learn it on your own. That takes a tremendous amount of time of trial and errors. And sometimes these errors can hurt you. So we see how that work out.
Yep, those errors can set you back. And if you're young, well, you can, youth can help bail you out sometimes.
Yeah, youth will help you and bail you out. Because as you get older, you don't want to be taking them type of chances.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So anyway, LA, I hope I contribute to
you
the show.
Sure did, and I got those emails. I'm going to read them over in a few minutes. And I'm up here cooking, so I won't burn up.
What are you preparing?
Just basic spaghetti bolognese. Something.
Well, you know what I do with my hang on before you go. You know what I do with my spaghetti after I cook it? I put the hamburger and Italian sausage. I fry that up with green peppers and onions. I take that spaghetti and after it's cooked, I wash it the hell out of it, get the starch out of it. Then I take I use tomato puree, like a small can. And I mix that up with my hand. I don't use no spoon. I just put my hand in there and start squeezing it around.
Right.
Then I add the sauce. Either you can make your sauce or you can buy the sauce. Then you put in that meat and mix all that up. Then I put it in the oven and bake it. Man, you talking about something good.
I will try that. I've had baked ziti, but that's stupid. Somebody else. I'm gonna try that bacon.
All right, I'll let you get off here, man.
Okay.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Bye bye. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.